The next case on the court's calendar is State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company versus Stephen Tanner Hansen, case number 64484. Mr. Cass?
Good morning, Justices, Counsel. May it please the Court. I would like to spend 10 minutes or so and then save 5 minutes for rebuttal. During the initial 10 minutes, what I'd like to do is address the questions as framed by Judge Due from the United States District Court, and then also in a separate discussion address the what I characterize as a elaboration or supplementation to Judge Due's questions by this Court in its order granting the certification, which I'll explain. Question one broadly simply poses the question to this Court of whether Nevada is going to follow the CUMIS Doctrine. I think we can be clear and be in agreement that Nevada is silent on this question to date. But I would suggest on behalf of my client that there is a trajectory in place that's been in place for a significant period of time that would lead this Court to a resolution of the issue by answering the certified question no, that Nevada will not follow the CUMIS Doctrine. The reason for that is this is at its heart a question of attorney ethics. By virtue of the nature of the tripartite relationship, whereby an insurer agrees to not only indemnify its insurer, but also to defend it, that means hire a lawyer. And at times, although usually unified in their defense against the tort claimant's claims, sometimes there are issues on which the insurer and the insured do not have complete and perfect alignment to varying degrees. The question then becomes, how does that affect the nature of the attorney-client relationship between insurance defense counsel and the insured, the client? Ultimately, it becomes a question of ethics. And that's why I say that this Court already has a trajectory to follow, a path that's already in place that leads to answer the first question, no. We go back to the three, what I view to be critical opinions from the Standing Ethics Committee of the State Bar, in which in opinions 9, 26, and 28, the Standing Committee, which does not provide binding law for this Court to follow, but nevertheless demonstrates the activities of the State Bar, the Supreme Court, and that committee in policing the lawyers of the state of Nevada. In those three opinions, the committee dealt with issues that are the kinds of things that come out all the time in these CUMIS cases. Opinion number 9 dealt with a lawyer that learned in confidence that his client had committed fraud on an insurer in the inception of the policy. The second opinion dealt with the duties of an insurance defense counsel in a construction defect case. The third one dealt with the issue of who does the file belong to, kind of a much more mundane question. Importantly, however, in those three opinions, it was unequivocally stated that Nevada followed a single client model. There was no ambiguity about it. That was the statement that was made within those three ethics opinions. Until 2007, when the Nevada Yellow Cab case came down from this court, and that case, for the first time, issued a new pronouncement of law, which was that Nevada is following a dual client model where both the insured and the insurer are clients of insurance defense counsel absent a conflict. Why is that important in this case today? It's important for a number of reasons. We look at what happened to opinions 9, 26, and 28 after Yellow Cab. And Yellow Cab's not a CUMIS case. It's a lawyer disqualification case. The Standing Committee went back and it added an addendum to each of those three ethics opinions and said that with respect to the existence of the insurer as a client, these opinions are changed. They are otherwise intact. This is important for two major reasons. One is because it shows that the apparatus of this state, the bar, the Standing Committee, and this court as the ultimate arbiter of attorney ethics.
Counsel, let me ask you a question.
Yes,
this is depending on where you're going.
Yes.
Are you putting the onus strictly on the attorney and absolving the insurance company of all responsibility? Or are you saying the insurance company still has some responsibility where this potentially is a conflicted case that it's given to its attorney?
The insurer absolutely has a responsibility. The insurer has a responsibility to select competent counsel.
Well, I understand that part. That's the easy part.
Sure.
But we have a case, and should the insurance company at least have the attorney initially determine whether or not there's a potential conflict where, and if there's not, then there's no problem. The attorney can go forward representing the company as well as their client, so to speak, the insured, or do they just proceed and then they get into litigation, all of a sudden they're at this cross situation where there's a potential conflict looming as to does it bode for the insured or does it bode for the insurance company, and then the attorney has to back out without properly advising the client, or where do we go? What are we doing?
It does place a significant burden on insurance defense counsel to identify conflicts and to not take up on a case where there is a conflict that would bar the representation. However, I think the distinction is critical. In the Yellow Cab case, this court was careful to qualify its statement that the insurance company is a client, except where there is a conflict between the insurer and the insured, in which case that language can only mean that where there is a conflict between the insurer and the insured, insurance defense counsel under that circumstance has only one client, and that's the insured. And that is the path that I suggest leads this court to find a different route than California found in California.
Does that path stumble, though, on Rule of Professional Conduct 1.9A?
In which subject, Your Honor? I don't have the reference to 1.9 in my...
Well, 1.9A specifically says a lawyer who has formally represented a client in a matter prohibits that lawyer from representing a client in the same or a substantially related matter in which that person's interests are materially adverse to the interests without the client's consent and confirmed in writing. Now, in that circumstance, we have recognized dual representation in Yellow Cab. I don't think the amendments to the three standing committee opinions address analyze that rule of professional conduct, and I don't know that it, in a dual representation state, permits that to occur.
And the point, Your Honor, that I would like to make in response to that is that in the event of a conflict between insurer and insured, in that circumstance, insurance defense counsel only has one client, and that's the insured. And I think this was specifically contemplated in opinion number 9, in which the court made a statement that it presumed that defense counsel, by accepting compensation from the company, because at that time the insurer was not a client, it was a mere payor, that the compensation will not interfere with the attorney's independence and professional judgment, since the attorney should know whether or not his employment relationship requires that he render advice on questions of coverage. This state has a tradition of presuming that its lawyers will know who their client is, know what their obligations are with respect to that client, understanding that when they're in a situation where something they do might affect coverage, that they will either step back and not affect it, or if they have to take action which assists their client and does not assist the insurer.
Well, I got to tell you, going back nearly 30 years, facing the same issue, anytime there was a potential conflict between a coverage issue and the defense of a particular client, additional counsel was always brought in, at least in my experience, and that was my area of practice. And, there was an inherent conflict there, and so that's why I'm trying to reconcile what you're telling me, that even if there's a coverage issue and you're defending a particular client, that you just kind of step back and ignore that conflict. Well, and that your obligation is to that client, even though you're giving the insurance company advice that, hey, there might not be coverage here.
I think if a lawyer is giving advice to the insurer on issues of coverage, that lawyer is subject to discipline by the state bar. Right.
Doesn't that create an inherent conflict and a struggle that Kumis would take care of?
Well, Kumis would take care of it, and the issue we have with Kumis is the overbreadth of the remedy. It's not tailored to give equal consideration to the rights of both the insured and the insurer. And in point of fact, Kumis was a judicial enactment that only 3 years later had to be fixed by the state legislature of California because there were so many issues and so much ancillary litigation that was spawned by it. I think this really goes back to the second ethical opinion, number 28, which deals with the very thing that Centex Homes in their amicus brief brings up, which is I've got an insurance company asking me as defense counsel to answer questions about, hey, tell me about these covered claims, because by implication, they'll also be informing the insurer about the value of the non-covered claims. That lawyer identified that as an ethical problem. He went to the bar. The committee issued an opinion, and a resolution of that was effected whereby, without the permission of the client, the insurer, that lawyer was prohibited from giving that advice to the carrier. It was dealt with within the constraints of the rules of ethics. We don't need the remedy of Kumis to affect that. And if there is a problem that needs to be addressed, we believe it's better addressed by the legislature, which is exactly what the state of California had to do.
Let me ask you just an unrelated question. Sure. In this day and age, at least my understanding is a lot of the companies are bringing firms in-house to handle some of these smaller claims. Is that the case?
I think that the presence of staff counsel is well-entrenched, and certainly a lot of litigation in the state is now handled by staff counsel operations. And they, I think, for the most
part... Do they have the same duty and obligation?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It does not vary at all. And I think that they are...
Does that create an appearance that is very unseemly?
I think that it is handled largely by... handing those cases to outside counsel in the event of exposure above limits, coverage questions, things like that.
Right, and these are a particular group of outside counsel.
Well, I mean, every carrier, just by the nature of having to transact this business that they're in, has a panel of outside counsel that they generally use as a matter of practicality. I'll briefly touch on what I view as an enhancement of the question as identified by this court, which is that you need to look at the facts of the case. And very briefly, let me just comment that this is not an opportunity for the respondents to relitigate or get reconsideration of summary judgment orders that have already been entered in this case. If this court is inclined to go in the direction of Kumis, I would suggest that this is not a case which involved a disqualifying conflict of interest on the part of defense counsel. This is a case in which they suggest that counsel should have pushed the claim as if there was some control over this to the higher limits of the homeowner's policy, of the $100,000 homeowner's policy, rather than steer it into the lower limits of the auto policy. I would suggest that that is a purely fantastical notion, and it is not an actual conflict, because we now know, with the benefit of hindsight, that, in fact, there's no coverage under the homeowner's policy. This is a theoretical conflict.
But isn't that something that would be better evaluated by independent counsel?
The question of whether there was a conflict or not?
Yes, conflict inherent in the two policies and the limits.
Well, I think that the dispute between the insured and the insurer is going to be there no matter what defense counsel does. The question is, can insurance defense counsel, in the presence of that dispute, carry out his obligations to a single client, the insured? Our position is defense counsel in this case represented only the Aguilars because of the qualification language in Yellowcat.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kass.
Thank you.
Mr. Bowen?
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, fellow justices, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm very grateful to be here. I want to start with some of the comments that I think that you made, which I think are spot on the questions. I want to start with, in Yellow Cab, when this court did that decision, it specifically referenced several jurisdictions. One of the jurisdictions it referenced was California, in a case by State Farm. State Farm versus Federal Insurance Company. And in that State Farm Federal Insurance Company case, it referenced that in other cases for the proposition that you can have dual representation. And in that dual representation, each client is represented by the attorney, by the appointed attorney, as long as there's not a real conflict. So the question is, we're not talking a potential conflict, we're talking a real conflict. And it's not about attorney ethics. It's not about insurance company ethics when we put insurance bad faith claim laws in. It doesn't mean because we have insurance bad faith claim laws that every insurance company is unethical. This court has promulgated and enunciated those types of guidance in a plethora of case law. Same thing with this. You can enunciate guidance for this type of issue, just like they did in California. So let me tell you what they said in that case, in that State Farm case. The court said, and I quote, it said, in analyzing the attorney-insured relationship, the courts have acknowledged that as a practical matter, the attorney may have closer ties with the insurer than the insurer. So right there, that court is recognizing that in our experience, because of this so-called dual relationship, there's likely to be closer ties with the attorney and the insurer than the attorney and the insured. So if we were to take their view, if you all in your learned wisdom were to take the appellant's view and not Judge Dew's view and not our view, then you would say, well, what's going to happen in a situation where there is unintentional disclosure of confidential information? If I am an attorney and I am there and I'm hired to represent the insurer, I'm not hired to talk about insurance coverage. I'm not hired as insurance counsel. I'm not there to learn about what the insurance is, what the availabilities are. I'm there to defend the client's liability to the best of my ability. So if we take their view, does that mean we're going to put the onus on defense counsel to understand insurance policies and understand what insurance is available and how it's affected? I don't think we want to put that duty on insurance defense lawyers. There, if there is a question about insurance coverage, as there was in this underlying state court case, then they appoint insurance counsel that is there to talk about insurance. Now, how do we know they did that? In the November 2005 letter, that's a key letter, November 2005, that's a letter from State Farm to Hall, Jaffe, and Clayton, to Mr. Clayton. And it says, essentially, you're being retained to defend the liability of the Aguilars, Ernie and Brad Aguilar. But we want to let you know, we have retained, as independent counsel, Nils Pearson, to make sure that we're covered on the insurance aspects. So now they come before the court and they say, boy, we had no idea there's this separation and we may have to have independent counsel, when they had it in this very case. The problem is they had it for themselves. They didn't have it to protect the interests of the insured in making sure that insurance coverage was preserved and the insured was not left to hang out to dry for personal liability. They had it for themselves. All we're saying is when you looked at Yellow Cab, you recognized that. You recognized that you needed to have a situation where, what do we do in the case of a conflict? Now, I want to touch a little bit on waiver and informed consent, because one of the issues that lawyers have is we write status letters. And that's an issue in this case. And that's an issue with regards to CUMIS required counsel. I use the term CUMIS required counsel separately than CUMIS, the case. Because CUMIS, the case, is a case, and there is it's codified, and there were some changes to the codification, but all of that whole process is necessarily referred to as CUMIS required counsel. And that says essentially this: when you have a conflict that is presented that is real, if the lawyer who has the ability in defending the case in the tripartite relationship if he can influence and has influence potential for coverage so that coverage may be lost, there is a conflict. And you need independent counsel because that lawyer has now influenced the ability of that insured to retain their coverage. Now, here in Nevada, that's a big deal. We've got small communities. We've got large communities. We've had people who depend on that. We have people who depend on insurance. But when they get sued, a small business, they need to know that someone is there. When a lawyer's hired, and their insurance company says, here's my lawyer. Here's your lawyer. We're paying for it. What's that lawyer doing? Now I want to talk about informed consent because professional rule responsibility 1.8, that's a key one, 1.8. That says client gives informed consent. It says a lawyer cannot accept compensation from someone other than the client unless client gives informed consent to representation. There's no question, Mr. Chief Justice, fellow justices, that the person, when they undertake the policy, they give consent. It says in there, you will let us defend you and hire the lawyer. But do they give informed consent for the negligent, inadvertent, and or intentional disclosure of confidential information? If I'm a lawyer and I am so ingrained in the case and I'm sending status letters to the carrier and I'm saying, this is my summary. This is how I paint the picture. This is how I paint the facts. And I say, and because I'm painting it in this regard, I'm telling you, the carrier, I'm potentially influencing coverage. And that's exactly what happened here. They took the facts from day one, and they argued this as an auto case. They knew about the prior events. They knew that it started in the backyard. They knew it started as a discussion, and then a little bit of intimidation came out. The automobile in this case was not the impetus for Aguilar's liability. It was part of the causal chain, which began in an event that occurred before that Mr. Aguilar was a part of. But because of the way they characterized the defense and sent that to the carrier, then the carrier said, you don't have coverage. You don't have coverage under the homeowner's policy. That lawyer, I am not I'm not casting any dispersions on defense counsel. That can be done innocently. That can be done unintentionally. But it can be done because you simply think you're trying to do your job. That's the problem here. So, bringing it full circle, yellow cab, we argue, you understand that it is longstanding. If there's a conflict in the relationship, then you've got to do something about it. Okay? It's something, you cannot continue to have that tripartite relationship.
Where was the coverage for intentional acts under the homeowner's policy?
There wouldn't be, Your Honor.
Where was there coverage under the homeowner's policy?
We argued, Your Honor, that there was coverage for negligent acts that occurred outside the vehicle by Mr. Aguilar. And what's interesting, Mr. Chief Justice Hardesty, is that they did too. They put it in a letter to the carrier, but then they said he had no part of this. In other words, they laid out the prior events that occurred where negligence occurred. And then they just conveniently left out Mr. Aguilar. They conveniently left out who he was, who he was associated with, what he did, what he said. And they said, then he got in his car and he took off after him and he hit him at the gate and that didn't cause hardly any damage and he didn't do anything else. They completely ignored Mr. Chief Justice.
Unless I misunderstand the facts, I thought Hansen was injured with rock throwing that occurred after he exited the gate.
He did, but that causal chain of events was a part of an occurrence, which was a chain of events. But the injury, Your Honor, wasn't that rock throwing was not the only event.
Everything started in the backyard.
Yes. Yes. Everything started in the backyard. We argued there were two occurrences, Your Honor, where there was no intervening cause. Okay? There's no intervening cause. They were causally connected. So you take a situation where you have an appointed defense counsel. And they're looking at it, and what's interesting about the November 2005 letter, and I hope you'll look at that, and I'm sure you have, is right off the bat, the carrier says this is an auto case. This is an auto case. They immediately put it in Mr. Clayton's mind, the retained counsel. The adjusters had it in their mind. The homeowner's policy, Mr. Chief Justice, never investigated the incident. So you had this pattern, and CUMIS, the beautiful thing about the CUMIS requirement is it deals with this type of situation. It deals with consent, informed consent. So let's fall back and say, let's say we had CUMIS and the insurance company would be required to do what CUMIS requires. Mr. Aguilar, we're going to appoint you counsel, but we need to tell you that counsel has over 100 cases with State Farm. He's representing State Farm. We need to tell you that the majority of his income is derived from that. We need to tell you he's been working with them this long. And there's a chance that he's going to do status letters, and there's a chance that when he does these status letters or the way that he defends the case may negate coverage. Now, so the question is, do you want independent counsel? Because we're going to talk about informed consent, which is everything. You can't have consent without informed consent. Then we have to talk about this issue. And that's what CUMIS
does. Could you use your remaining time to discuss why a reservation of rights is a per se conflict? Aren't there circumstances in which there could be a reservation of rights and it not create a conflict?
Yes. In candid, yes, Mr. Chief Justice.
So shouldn't the rule, there seems to be different approaches in the jurisprudence to that subject. Which do you advocate, that the court should assess that on a case-by-case basis and determine actual conflict, which seems to be what California did, or perhaps in Massachusetts make it a per se conflict?
Well, I think, Mr. Chief Justice, we should probably follow what we do here in Nevada, and that's a case-by-case basis. I think that's consistent with Nevada law. I think you have a long, excellent history of saying that. That we look at things on a case-by-case basis, which is what California does. And so, Mr. Chief Justice, what I would say is this. This is what we would like. And this is what I think is bringing full circle, closing the circle on Yellow Cab. Yellow Cab almost completed the circle, but Yellow Cab didn't account for the inadvertent disclosure of confidential information which could lead to a negation of coverage. Same type of thing. You've got inadvertent disclosure potential with Mr. Vanna's firm. That was the issue in Yellow Cab. Justice Gibbons, as you know, that was the issue. And you've got that potential inadvertent disclosure. So here's what California has, which I think is wise. CUMIS counsel is appointed to control the defense for the defendant. He's to work independently of the insurance company, but with insurance counsel. He's to behave ethically. Ethical rules still apply. He's to disclose all information concerning the action except privileged information, which obviously in a tripartite relationship, the risk is always there to gain privileged information. You were concerned about that in Yellow Cab. Mr. Vanna didn't represent him up through the settlement, but he had potential privileged information that could have been used against the insurance company. Same thing here. Cooperate with the insurance appointed defense counsel. Cooperate with the insurance defense counsel will cooperate with CUMIS counsel in all aspects of litigation. Exchange documents and information consistent with ethics. And then the insurance counsel can represent his client without disclosing confidential information. Now, I will close with this. Judge Due made a good observation. She said, it's like the example on special jury instructions. A lawyer defending an insurance defense lawyer defending his insured, and he does special instructions, and he's trying to do those to best of their ability. And when they do them, they may do them in the sense that when they give them to the jury, and the jury has them, that may negate coverage, something that counsel does not want to do. So just in closing, we don't want to put that burden on tripartite counsel, sole counsel, to no insurance. They handle all the insurance aspects. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bowen. Any questions by the court? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cass, you've got a couple minutes. I'll give you 2 minutes to wrap up your position and respond to counsel.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. Counsel made the comment that this is not about attorney ethics. Attorney ethics is everything on this issue. And it's very important to understand the distinction between a conflict between the insured and the insurer and compare it to a potential conflict between insurance defense counsel and his client, the insured.
Well, what about the hiring of Niels Pearson? I'm confused at that.
That was my second point, Justice Cherry. Niels Pearson was coverage counsel for State Farm. The Aguilars had their own personal counsel as well, David Sampson. It's not an informative point in this case. The question is, did the Aguilars need a different defense lawyer besides Hall, Jaffe, and Clayton? There was coverage issues in the case. Pearson represented State Farm on the coverage issues. Sampson was the insurer's personally retained counsel. Sampson never tendered the defense, asked for Cumis counsel. The request was never made. In 2006, in this case, summary judgment was entered against Brad Aguilar on the negligence.
But aren't we just answering the question from Federal Judge Dew? In other words, we're just answering the question about Cumis counsel versus no Cumis counsel.
And the question, the answer to the question is, do you want to adopt what is a new remedy for the state?
There's just no remedy at this point, but according to my colleague, Justice Berger, there's been a policy.
My answer to the question is that the answer to Judge Dew's question should be no, because to answer it yes would require this court to grant a new remedy. The reason for that is we already have strong ethical rules in place, as evidenced by the ethical opinions number 9, 26, and 28, each one of which, particularly 9 and 26, involved questions of lawyer ethics that could have been the subject for a Cumis demand that were handled by the State Bar and the committee.
One last question.
Yes.
Shouldn't have Hall Jaffe, when Hall Jaffe realized that they needed to get the coverage counsel, should they have said we need Cumis counsel here?
They didn't need to say that because they never got involved in issues of coverage. And at every opportunity where there was some place where they had to do something to choose one client versus the other, if State Farm was a client, our position is they weren't, they clearly stepped on the side of the insured. They made demands to settle non-covered claims. There was judgment on a covered claim entered in 2006 on this case.
That's the automobile policy?
Yeah, on the auto policy.
But nothing on the homeowners?
Right. If Mr. Clayton had done what they say and he should have pushed it towards the homeowners, what he would have ended up doing is exactly what Cumis was designed to prevent, and that would have pushed him into a non-covered claim. Then he'd have malpractice exposure. So I will rest simply to say that let the legislature do it.
Your argument, Mr. Cass, is that under single representation, that lawyer has to make an assessment about the facts of the case and how best to defend the insured, but at the same time must make an assessment about whether that defense impacts coverage. So aren't we putting defense counsel in an awkward position very early in the case?
It comes with the territory, Justice Hardesty. And if that lawyer simply treats that...
It might come with the territory for lawyers, but it has severe consequences for litigants.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And if that defense lawyer treats that client that he has been hired to represent as if that client was writing him a check out of his own personal household checking account for his services, and he defends him to the best of his abilities, and he doesn't disclose confidential information that will help the carrier on coverage, of which there is no evidence in this case, then that lawyer will be doing the right thing. This state can trust its defense lawyers to do the right thing, and it can trust the state bar and civil justice system for attorney malpractice to police when one of those lawyers strays.
Chief, if I may, I've got one last question. There are approximately 22 states that recognize the Cumis counsel role, correct?
The counting can be difficult, but yes, that's a fair number.
Give or take 22 jurisdictions. I would assume each and every one of those jurisdictions have rules relating to lawyer conduct, just as you're indicating here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My response...
Doesn't that cut against your argument slightly?
I think that the mere fact that other states have decided to follow the California lead should not lead this court necessarily in that same direction. Other states, such as Hawaii and Washington and Tennessee, have a different approach. They have heightened scrutiny on the defense counsel. They also trust their lawyers, and they put a higher level of scrutiny on the insurer and the insured to make sure that those things that we're concerned about, which are legitimate concerns, don't take place. It's a better remedy. It balances the interests of the insureds of this state with the legitimate interests of the insurers to appoint counsel under their policies, keeps them in balance without creating a swell of litigation, ancillary litigation, which is exactly what happened in California when the Court of Appeal decided to legislate that solution.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Cass. Mr. Bowen, excellent arguments and briefing, and thanks to the contributions from the Miki as well. Case will stand submitted.